poem that I wrote when I was in Rome, and I literally landed at the train station in Rome, having come from the airport, hearing in my ear the warnings from the woman at the American Academy who said, whatever you do, don't get in a gypsy taxi, Caroline. And I just, of course, then I looked for them. I recognized them. I couldn't get in one, but then I wrote the poem anyway. So, and I think that's sort of what you have to do. That's the risk you take as a poet. You can take it in poetry, you know?
Yeah. What is a gypsy taxi?
It's one that isn't registered with the city of Rome. It's a renegade taxi. It's a rogue taxi. It's cheaper. It's different colors, has no numbers, and has a gypsy at the helm, I'm sure. When you arrive, it's waiting, the door held open like Cinderella's coach. In your best bad Italian, tell the driver the address, gasping as he whirls you past the Colosseum, stopping for no one, man or machine, and everywhere read the signs, cambio, cambio. His eyes caressing your face, your neck, your breasts, his coral shirt throbbing, his smile a photograph catching you, like water moving inside the body of your dream. Beneath the canopy of laundry, Da Lucia is waiting for you at dusk in Vicolo di Matonato. Lounging on the steps of the fountain in the piazza of Santa Maria in Trastevere, veiled in spray, nameless, touching the loneliness that wanders like a gypsy through this world.
That is Caroline Russell reading her poem Gypsy Taxi out of her book of poetry by the same name. Caroline has written 4 volumes of poetry. She is an English professor at Bemidji State University, and she recently received an artist fellowship from the Region 2 Arts Council. The fellowship supports her creation of a new volume of work. This new book of poems will combine new works with selections from her past. A fellowship.
Yeah.
How did you get to this point?
It's many years of writing, of course, and then going to the workshops, the MFA, working on the first manuscript, sending out poems for many years, because you need to do that in order to be published the first time.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate when the University Presses of Florida took my manuscript, but almost didn't get that letter. That is such a funny story where I didn't hear from them. And so a poet friend of mine in Kansas, Michael Heffernan, called me and said, have you heard from the University Presses of Florida yet? And I said, no. And he said, well, you need to call the editor. And I was kind of, really? And he said, oh, yes, call the editor and specifically ask about your manuscript. And I did call the editor, and he answered, and he knew right away about my that I had been chosen to be published. And he said, you didn't get the letter? And I said, no, I didn't get the letter. I was living in rural Missouri at the time in a town of 600 people. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it just blew out of the mailbox, you know. So I always felt like Michael Heffernan, you know, was just kind of touching that with a little bit of luck and blessing.
Which book was that?
The Red Envelope, the very first book.
The Red Envelope.
Imagine not getting the letter and me never responding. I mean, so I felt very fortunate.
The irony.
I know, the envelope that goes under the carpet, right, in the Victorian novel or whatever.
So what year was that?
Oh, and I should read that poem because it has a touch of Minnesota in it. Strangely enough, that would have been about 1983, 84, right in there. And I actually had a poem in here where I was hoping to come back to Minnesota. It's the strangest thing. And I wrote this poem after finding an envelope in the bottom of my grocery bag in that tiny little town, a red envelope that was had nothing in it. And I've talked about how when I'm tapped to write a poem, it's usually a touch of the numinous in it, where I feel like, oh, yeah, this is an invitation to write a poem. And so when I saw that, I thought, well, something's going to happen, and I won't be in this little town forever. And I'm going to write this poem. And it turned to galvanize the entire book, the title, and bring me back here. So the red envelope comes to us empty, unexpected as pain in the left arm driving to work, and the light bird in the chest wakens from its rhythmic rocking to flutter toward the throat, or the child we believed in turns for the first time. As an old friend, dead or forgotten, it arrives, following lines on our faces, singing its wolf song. In Minnesota, wolves are silver. A moon sound comes out of them, feathering snow endlessly down into the red mouth, hiding its true color as though it were a life we are trying to forget. Always with a promise, a neatly squared opening, a sound to hide or reveal what we barely remember, the moment it is wrenched from the body. That ending was kind of shocking for me as well. But somehow it feels often like that when you're working on poetry, because it's not something that's really easy to write.
But it comes out naturally,
yes,
too, sometimes.
It does. When you get it flowing and you've taken the invitation or the opportunity, and then when you get to that point where it starts to come together, it's very exciting. And time does just disappear and stop. And I love that feeling of being right in the moment and getting it to just fit like a perfect puzzle.
Carol Ann's poetry can be described as lyrical, spiritual, and autobiographical.
Which at first was not okay. You know, those were late comers to the scene of respected poetry, the autobiographical poets. They were viewed as people who wrote about their problems. You know, think of Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath as women, of course, but then before that, Robert Lowell and Hartsneedle writing about his psychoanalytic sessions. Even though they were free verse and sort of stream of consciousness, they were suspect and they were kind of put over here. So, but yet that is truly what drew me to poetry, was the loss of my father, his suicide when I was 20. And it was just impossible to work with that until I met my poetry teacher, Richard Hugo, who understood all about that. He was in the same war. He was in the Pacific Theater. And my father was, he was in the European Theater. My father was in the Pacific Theater. He was in the air. My dad was on water. It was perfect. And he understood this idea of the deep need to affirm loyalty and forgiveness and hope when something seems beyond you, completely beyond you. And it turns out, look at what's happening now in our culture. I just heard an interview with Dan Johnson, the guy who wrote The Hemingway Way, you know, for the veterans who commit suicide. I couldn't believe it. I just stopped my car and listened to the whole thing and thought, this could never have happened if it hadn't been for the work that all of us were doing back in the 70s with this stuff, with the Vietnam War, because it was just sort of pushed aside. In the men who served and the women who served as well, they couldn't talk about it. It was taboo. They had no language. They had no way to validate it, teach us about it, or somehow, bless it and let it go.
And poetry became that.
It is the way. It's the way, because our language is so materialistically used, especially with the virtual devices that we have at our fingertips, literally. Mm. So that when we go back to the simple, slow way of words kind of magnetically gathering themselves on the page after just trusting your creative imagination, out come these unconscious jewels that are ready to be translated, if you will, by the beauty of the art. My influences, Richard Hugo, Madeline DeFries, and Tess Gallagher, all gave me something. Truth from Hugo, this conversational voice that then reveals truth. Time with Tess Gallagher, because she was interested in how the poem becomes a reservoir for time. And so one can re-enter moments of time and complete them in a poem. And spirit in Madeline DeFries, when she talks about reclaiming what is lost and honoring the lowly, that was important to her. And I learned something really important from her. And they're so different, all three of them. They were perfect for me.
That is Carol Ann Russell. She is a poet from Bemidji. And we're talking about influences and inspiration. And I'm wondering, Carol Ann, what your creative process is like.
That creative process always begins with a really strong feeling. And this poem called Renegade Memorial. With that one, I had just returned from a funeral for a man who was a high school friend of mine. And, you know, you don't really know yourselves in high school. You don't know what your potential selves may be, but you do know the essential self. And he and I were friends, you know. And after many years later, I learned that he was gay and that he was living with a partner and so on. And he was a wonderful artist. And all of these things didn't surprise me, because I think I sensed that potential in him all along. But when I went to his funeral and they dispersed the ashes, I felt like that death kind of released me to go back into my own heart and work with some of those hidden areas as well. But what I had hidden, you know, all of us hide in our little lives in our small towns when we're in high school, kind of emerged in this poem when I found one line. And the line was, "Our private Vietnam." Isn't that interesting? Because that is certainly a touchstone for all of us in my age group, where so many of the, I guess, the suffering and anything that has to do with inexplicable suffering and sacrifice would go. So may I read this one?
Absolutely. So it's called?
Renegade Memorial. You were the first boy to ask me, crossing empty space of seventh grade at Holmes Junior High School, taking my hand dancing to unseen guitar across the ocean, shifting, rising, and falling. Minor key to major in three movements, a perfect marriage of black and white keys, left hand in concert with the right. Now, across the frozen lakes of Minnesota, we are fingerprints gone missing in a storm. Unrecognized, classmates, our private Vietnam, tattooed by song. The Beatles, the Grateful Dead, too young to know. Our eyes still meet, trees dance with wind, dropping their leaves overnight. Tracing your paintings online, veins on skin, paths not taken, mixed with years and gray, leading to this garden of ash, where we love at last. So, and that was for Danny Irvin.
There's a lot of imagery in there.
Mm-hmm. You know, poets are often busy entertaining ghosts. I mean, that's kind of what we do. You know, we work with the leftovers left on the floor and, you know, the cuttings left from somebody's life. You know how we trim off things in order to have a life, in order to have a some kind of meaningful narrative for ourselves. Well, the losses and the wounds and the ghosts and the forgotten, that's what poets work with. And that's what we do as our work. I talk to students about, you know, you're doing more than just writing. When you love this, it becomes the work you do for the world. That sounds egoistic, but it's not. It's the simple stuff. It's sweeping up the scraps, working in by yourself, piecing something together out of nothing, and then sharing it, you know, until you read it, or especially reading it aloud like we do at the coffee house. It's so meaningful to hear people's work. Mm-hmm. All these writers in Bemidji who are writing this incredible stuff. It's great to be here.
So what is it about poetry that you love?
Well, it's a way to fall in love with the world. It's a way to have your arguments with yourself, which they always are with yourself. So it's a way to turn things in our world in which there's so much divisiveness and polarization. Poetry is all about bringing in the parts that have been dismissed or forgotten or devalued. And so poets do that kind of basement work for us. And consequently, we have beauty where there wouldn't be any beauty. And we have meaning where there seems to be no meaning. Look at these poems written about these various wars, you know. Or like Auden says, you know, you don't find the truth in the news. It's not there. So, you know, we're always hit with all of this stuff. And where do we find that piece that resolves something for us, that makes us, lifts us up and makes us feel like we're in more than just this world?
Yeah.
You know, there's the other world, too.
Yeah.
So the world of spirit. Mm.
That is Carol Ann Russell. She is an English professor at Bemidji State University. She's written 4 volumes of poetry and has just received a fellowship from the Region 2 Arts Council that will allow her to write a 5th volume of poetry. And this new book will combine poems from her past as well as new and selected works. You'll revisit a piece.
Exactly, you do. And that spark that's in there stays alive, mm-hmm. you know. And I talk a bit about revisioning poems when I'm putting together this new and selected manuscript, which is what I applied to the fellowship for. Some of these older poems may change in this process. They often do for poets at my point in their writing career, because they're still alive in the unconscious. And they may not have completely revealed themselves in terms of their relationships with new things to come, because in art there is no time. It's always just one time, like a series of spirals kind of fitting together like those old-fashioned slinkies. And so when I talked about this new and selected manuscript, I talked about my work being familial in the sense that the books have relationships with each other that I believe will be clarified in this new manuscript. I hope so.
Read some more poems.
All right. Let's see. You asked me about my new work.
Yeah.
And I think what's happening with it is it's becoming simpler in its language. And so, and that's interesting. I don't know exactly what that means. This one I wrote for my son, older son. Another time, a butterfly swims past the window, orange wings, unfolding sky. I am in the car. I am driving with my son. He is 18. We have had lunch with a philosophy professor and talked with a psychiatrist. We took the detour and are lost. On the other side of the Red River from where I was born. He studies the map. He tells me where we are, heading toward Dunvilla and away from the past. The car runs, steady, rocking us, gentle over the rolling hills. Somewhere we stop and find miniature toys, robots that blink and walk, a tin rocket that twirls, and a wind-up clock with twin bells on top. A kaleidoscope, I turn inward. The light, broken, shards, color slides into design. I am speaking to you now. You choose a set of fake mustaches and a small metal bird. For a split second, we know each other. See what I mean? There's something different happening in these. It's more simple. It's a little more transparent. And it surprises me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and I think that's the Eastern surprise that's in haiku and things like that. I've got one for my youngest son, which again has to do with time. Z time. Born by dream and a vision, be breath from the grandfathers. I called you in, golden sun. Queen mother am I because you came. Together we survived 12 days under watchful care, St. Luke himself in charge, never out of my sight, held by heartbeat, safe from the thrall of hospital machines. Barefoot and free, proof no doctor can love back life like a mother and son in cahoots with the great artist. When they let us go, your father drove straight to the rest home, and great-grandma Avis rocked you, and somewhere a piano played, "What a friend we have in Jesus." In the sunny day room, we sang along, unaware of your blessing. I could read Silver Dollar, which was the poem that brought this last full-length book together before Gypsy Taxi.
Okay.
And this one, literally, I wanted to write, couldn't write. And I did have silver dollars that my father had collected, and I remember holding those and wondering how to write this poem. And then all of a sudden, it just started as a kind of story, you know, like they do sometimes. So, and I think it's especially pertinent now when, you know, people are still warring, there's a lot of violence, and all of us feel unsafe. Silver dollar. Once we were safe for democracy. Dad bought a square black safe, which became the country he had fought for, silently beating back fire and flood to guard against the multiplication of fate. What divided us were the silver dollars wrapped in green felt, heavy as stone. I dreamed he dropped them in the sea when he died, the flag folded like a napkin on his coffin. I stashed one away like a war medal, another sliver of his heart, plunging it deep into the drawer next to the silky things as the silver woman with her torch slipped into my chest. Thereafter, on the day of his death, it throbs like a boji stone or the shrunken heart of a child. I hang it on a silver chain between my breasts. Men want to kiss me there, tracing blue veins with their tongue, saying my skin tastes of salt and metal as if they know I have a keepsake and they want to lay their hands on it. Sometimes my heart moves and I feel silvery cold, afraid that I am lost in the middle of my life because my father is dead. Then it rolls toward me smooth as silk, like an act of love, an island, and I feel the little craziness that is hope. Hot days when a breeze bursts, then lingers, tracing faint halos of watermarks on the countertops, and gently pushing the white paper napkins onto the checkered floor where they flutter like blank pages torn from some book. Somebody like me lays down hard silver from the past among the green wings of dollar bills, sewn with tiny red and blue threads from invisible flags, lifting it like a manhole off the heart, letting anyone who wants to touch it for the moment for nothing. You see all the stuff that's wrapped up in that that's still being worked out in our country, in ourselves. All these young men and women who given their lives and for what? You know, for us to feel safe, for democracy, for all of those things. And notice how the dream came in to save me? Dreams can do that. Dreams are a lot like poetry.
That is poet Carol Ann Russell. She is currently working on her new volume of poetry. It'll be a collection of new and selected works, and it will be available soon. I'm Katie Carter. Area Voices is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and by the people of Minnesota.